James Buchan joins us now. He's a former Middle East correspondent, novelist, and author of Days of God, The Revolution in Iran and Its Consequences. James, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
You first went to Iran in 1974. What was it like then to show up there?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that, Rod.
You first went to Iran in 1974. What was it like? What was your first impression there?
Well, I arrived there because I was a student of I was studying Persian at university in England, and it was just after the oil price hike. In the winter of 73-74, oil prices went up fourfold, and Britain just turned off its power stations, and people were laid off and had to work just 3 days a week. And what struck me most arriving in Iran was that all the lights were on, that the country was going through a boom because it was on the receiving end of all this oil revenue. And I'd left Europe in darkness, and I arrived in this country where everything was bright.
Did it feel like a place that was just 5 years from a major revolution?
Well, to be honest, I thought that Iran was going to hell. I really did. But I couldn't, I didn't, you know, I was 18, 19 years old. I didn't have the understanding to see what sort of hell it was heading for. And it was really then that I first thought of writing about the place. But it took many, many years for me to gather the understanding to be able to do it.
How did the movement against the Shah of Iran develop? Why were Iranians frustrated with him?
Well, the royal house that the Shah belonged to, they were called Pahlavi, was a quite recent foundation. His father seized the throne in 1925 and embarked, both father and son, on the rapid industrialization and modernization of what was a very, very backward traditional country. And they went about it, as we say in England, like a bulleted gate. They and brooked no opposition. And they suppressed parliamentary government, turned the press into a group of sycophants, and repressed dissent, so that Iranians who felt they were being torn this way and that by the very rapid development of the country also felt that they were being turned into infants, turned into children by the Shah. And the regime was very unpopular. It's just that in comparison to what followed, the Pahlavi era looks like a golden age of prosperity and justice in comparison to the Islamic Republic that came into being in 1979, which has not been successful at all, and particularly not in the areas where the Pahlavis were successful, which is in the development of the economy.
Well, at the time, a lot of people didn't see a close link between Shiite Islam and politics. In fact, as you write, I think there was a discomfort in the role of the Shia movement with direct involvement of politics. How did it become such an important role in the revolution and then in the ruling of the Islamic Republic?
Well, it was through the personality of Khomeini and his character and his unbending will. Shia Islam is pretty dynamic in the way it interprets Muslim scripture, and he devised a theory of government, Khomeini did, while he was in exile. He was exiled by the Shah in 1964. He developed a theory of government in which power would be devolved to the clergy, and they would run the country. And this turned out to be a bit of a surprise to the secular opponents of the Shah, But they could see in the course of mass demonstrations in 1978 that Khomeini was pretty good at mobilizing the masses. And so they were happy to go along with the religious movement. What they didn't foresee was that after the Shah went into exile in 1979, there would be essentially a civil war in which Khomeini and his circle destroyed all opposition in Iran, the left, the sort of centrist nationalists, and the secular forces, in order to enforce his vision of what Islamic government should be. And that's an error that, you know, the millions of Iranians in exile still brood over in Britain and, you know, Germany and, you know, in California.
And at this point in global history, when you rebelled against a Western allied autocracy, usually it was either a nationalist movement that ended up taking over or a communist movement taking it over. This was a new animal, wasn't it? This Islamic theocracy.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and in a way, Rod, it was also a harbinger of the end of the Cold War. Because if one could imagine if a leftist government had taken power in 79 in Iran when the Shah left, that leftist government would have been left high and dry 10 years later when the Soviet Union fell to bits. So the Iranian Revolution was pointing to the new era, which was slightly overlapping with the Cold War, but pointing to the post-war Cold War era, in which there would be this new Islamic radicalism, which would select for its enemy, you know, the United States, and you know, and that has lasted for you know, for 30 years. There was a particular problem with Iran in that Khomeini destroyed the Shah's army, which he did for reasons where, one can understand. He destroyed the Shah's army by, you know, shooting 400 generals. But in doing that, he profoundly altered the balance of power in the Middle East.
And we'll pick up that point in just a moment, James. We're talking to James Buchan. He's author of Days of God, The Revolution in Iran and Its Consequences. In just a few minutes, we'll talk about what happened after that balance of power shifted. First, I'm Rob Ferret, here with Veronica Rickert and Jean Purcell. It's our fall membership drive.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this is the Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Membership Drive, and we're here to let you know how important your support is. Your gift makes a huge difference. It's actually what powers the engine of Wisconsin Public Radio. Step up and be counted as a supporter with your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Now, last hour, we heard from, it looks like, about 23 of you. Thanks so much for those calls, for those pledges of support. We really appreciate each and every one of them. And with the new hour, we've got a brand new goal. Before 6 o'clock, we need to get 35 pledges. So let's get started now. Help us meet this goal by making a contribution at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552. And don't forget, the programs you enjoy will be here every day in Wisconsin Public Radio, thanks to your gift.
What happens in the rest of the world matters to us here, and that's why Wisconsin Public Radio is so important. We talk with experts like James Buchan in all kinds of fields from all over the world.
That's right, and we do it because getting the news from around the world and then bringing it to our own backyard is important, and we cover news from our backyard too, by the way. Because you value being an informed citizen, make a pledge to the station that keeps you connected. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Supporting Wisconsin Public Radio right now is a great thing to do with just a few minutes of your time, because that's really all it takes to become a member, just a few minutes of your time. You give us your name, you supply your contact information, decide how much you'd like to give, and how you'd like to pay. And whether you call or you pledge online, we always keep your personal information safe. We never share it with anybody else.
Nope, we never do that. And it's a reminder that your gift supports the stories, the programs like Central Time that keep you connected to the world. So give now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Many of us are committed to making our communities better places. For example, maybe you volunteer your time, maybe you recycle, or maybe you help those in need. Making a financial contribution to Wisconsin Public Radio is another thing that makes our communities better.
Yeah, it really does. And your investment, and it really is an investment, together with the donations from others, make this news, this music, and talk available on WPR to everyone. We're proud to be an important part of the Wisconsin community of listeners, so help us stay strong with your pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace. Every weekday morning, I get in my car,
NPR's business news,
and I go to work. A few hours of, and then I get to go home.
This is all.
But what if one day I'd feel like there was something missing, and I know you'd feel that way too. So please consider a sustaining membership to keep public radio going strong. Here's how to contribute, and thanks.
Pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm here with Jean Purcell. We're asking for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio during this fall membership drive. Maybe you're looking at your budget. You think, well, we can afford $10 a month. Maybe you can afford $20 a month. Well, whatever amount you decide is the right amount at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we do pledge drives like this asking for your support because we don't expect any one or even 100 listeners to carry the costs of this program, of this radio network. In fact, we believe that there is an advantage to having the bulk of our budget come from thousands of listeners just like you.
When we have that wide base of support, it really does make for a more stable organization. And when you pledge, it also lets us know something else. It lets us know that you value the programs that you get from Wisconsin Public Radio. So join in. Become a member. You decide the amount. $5 a month is a great starting place. And then pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
So maybe you donated a few years ago, like back in 2009, and you're listening to us right now and you think, you know what, I've done my part. But here's the thing, you've been listening day in and day out to WPR year after year since that pledge you made back in 2009. It's your continued support right now that keeps this organization strong.
Well, if it has been a while since you donated, this is the perfect time to rejoin at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, and we're really glad to have you back.
Absolutely. We'd love to welcome you back, and you can be one of those folks that helps us make our goal of just 32 more pledges before 6 o'clock, and we've got about 40 minutes to make them, so plenty of time and plenty of room for you. You fund the programs you rely on when you give right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
And thank you. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're back now with James Buchan. He's former Middle East correspondent, novelist. His new book is Days of God, The Revolution in Iran and Its Consequences. James, just before the break there, you mentioned Iran's military being in disarray after the revolution. And then their neighbor, Saddam Hussein, leader of Iraq, thought he saw an opportunity. The war that ensued, how did that affect Iran?
Rob, you're quite right. I mean, the first consequence was, of course, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan on at Christmas time in 1979. It's hard to imagine the Soviets going ahead with that if the Iranian army had still been at full strength. But just going to Saddam's invasion in 1980, that had the effect of stiffening the resistance of Iran and causing Iranians to rally behind their leaders. I mean, it was regarded at the time by some of the revolutionaries as a godsend. It also, the 8 years' war with Iraq, it also provided an atmosphere of crisis during which it was which permitted Khomeini to destroy his eternal enemies. So even though the effect of the war was shattering, in that something like 200,000 Iranians lost their lives, and after 8 years of war, it just went back to the status quo. Even though it did a great deal to solidify the revolution.
Did it bring a nationalist sentiment for people who might not have supported the theocracy but wanted to support their country against this foreign invader?
Yes, exactly that. I mean, the Iranians, as you know, are not Arabs and don't get on particularly well with the Arabs, and the feeling is pretty well mutual. There's a strong sense of, you know, Iranianness or Persianism. Of course, some Iranians in the course of the war left the country, but there was a great rallying behind the Islamic Republic. And there was a great deal of heroism shown on the battlefront. It's just a pity that the Iranian soldiers weren't better led. But like the First World War.
And another important chapter, of course, for us in the United States was the taking of hostages at the American embassy. What led up to that? There's been some people have viewed it as a very conscious, intentional policy on behalf of the leaders of the revolutionaries. Others as kind of this almost chaotic chain of events. What led up to that?
Well, I've come to the conclusion that the second is true. That the occupation of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, November the 4th, 1979, emerged out of the chaotic student politics of the time, and that Khomeini, when he was confronted with it and saw how popular it was, sided with the occupiers, with the hostage takers. And it was at that point that anti-Americanism, which was essentially a sort of leftist posture, you know, which still survives in sort of fossilized form in Iran long after it's been driven out, chased away pretty well everywhere else. That's when anti-Americanism became established as the principal pillar of the Islamic Republic. And as its main political posture, even though it in no way corresponds to the feelings of ordinary Iranians who are interested in the United States and quite enthusiastic about it.
How important was it that the United States had admitted the Shah of Iran, now in effect in exile after this revolution, the United States took him in?
It was completely unimportant, Rob. In a meeting, when Khomeini was in exile just outside Paris, in a meeting with a French diplomat who'd carried a message from President Carter, Khomeini asked the Americans to take the Shah. That was in early in 1979. So in the course of 8 or 9 months, he'd thoroughly changed his mind. It was a piece of, in many ways, typical of Khomeini. It was a piece of political opportunism, but the Islamic Republic is saddled with this anti-Americanism, it's going to, you know, it's in a mess now, and it's going to have to find some way out of it.
I've referred a couple times to Iran as a theocracy, yet we see elections for president of Iran, other elections there. How do the clergy exercise their control in Iran?
Rob, it's actually a hybrid Iran. It's a hybrid of a parliamentary democracy and a clerical dictatorship, and the contradictions between the two often produce strains and look to me to becoming intolerable in the end. It has regular elections, and these elections often throw up very, very surprising results, of which the most surprising of all was this landslide back in June of this year in the presidential election for this gentleman, not at all well known, Hassan Rouhani. The elections are tightly controlled. Only certain candidates can be put forward whose Islamic credentials are beyond dispute. But even so, it is, you know, if the definition of a democracy is it can turn up surprise results, well, then Iran is a democracy. It's not quite a democracy, not quite a theocracy.
Just in our last minute, I want to touch on Iran's nuclear ambitions. You mentioned a case that I hadn't heard before. Iran, the leaders of Iran, are suspicious of the idea of having a powerful standing army, so they maybe view the nuclear deterrent as better than building up conventional armed forces.
Well, Rob, that's completely correct. The Iranian armed forces in an offensive role are very weak. In a defensive role, they'd be something to reckon with. But when Iran began on this course of nuclear research back at the end of the 1990s, I don't think anybody realized that they would end up betting the farm on it, and that it would lead to the current situation in which the a mixture of incompetence and Western and United Nations sanctions has brought the economy to its knees. And Iran now needs to find some way of getting out of the nuclear impasse, while very important to everybody, but particularly to Iranians, while maintaining their dignity.
Well, that story is being continued this week, actually. James, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, Rob. Thank you very much.
That was James Buchan. His new book is Days of God, The Revolution in Iran and Its Consequences.
Coming up, are humans hardwired for war? You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.